the day on Against the Grain. Can women fleeing domestic violence get asylum in the U.S.? Jeff Sessions has taken steps to prevent that. How did it come to this, and what might happen to other asylum seekers? I'm CS. Karen Musallo joins me to discuss partner abuse, refugee law, and the fate, the potential fate, of thousands of people fleeing persecution, coming right up. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Are women who've suffered brutal physical abuse at the hands of their partners, are they entitled to asylum protection in the U.S.? Getting asylum depends on a number of things, including the kind of persecution that a person has suffered and her or his ability to get a fair hearing in the U.S. Recently, another obstacle to asylum was erected by none other than U.S. Attorney General Jeff Sessions, who invoked a rarely used power to refer an important asylum case to himself. That case involved a Salvadoran woman who endured 15 years of severe abuse at the hands of her husband and then ex-husband. After this nation's highest immigration court approved her asylum claim in December 2016, a hostile lower court judge and then Sessions himself intervened. What this case means and what it augurs is of immense importance, not just to refugee law and asylum adjudications in this country, but to the lives and well-being of domestic violence survivors who face a significant risk of further violence and indeed death if sent back to their home countries. Cases like the one Sessions referred to himself have been closely monitored by Karen Musallo, a law professor at UC Hastings College of the Law, where she directs the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. Musallo has written extensively on refugee law issues and has litigated a number of landmark cases. In fact, the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies is co-counsel in a case that challenges the way the Salvadoran woman's case is being applied at the border. When Karen Musallo joined me recently in studio, I asked her what the woman, who is called A.B. in court documents, suffered at the hands of her husband in El Salvador.
Well, shortly after they married, he became very abusive, really within a year or so of them getting together. And the abuse took many forms, from beatings and kickings, threatening her with knives, threatening her with guns, you know, threatening to hang her by a rope from the ceiling. They had three children together. The abuse continued throughout the pregnancies, you know, throughout the children that she bore. He was just vicious. He made the home sort of tantamount to a torture chamber. And he felt that he had the total right to act this way with impunity, because violence against women, many women's rights activists in El Salvador and human rights lawyers in El Salvador, you know, will readily concede that violence against women is quite normalized, not just tolerated, but really seen as the norm. And that sort of translates to this sense of absolute power that her husband had to treat her as he wanted. You know, there was no recourse for her. He had a brother who was a member of the police force and basically said to her that you won't get any recourse if you go to the police. And his brother even joined in the death threats to Miss A.B.
Now, she did approach the police, the authorities. What happened? Did they take measures to stop the abuse?
So she did, on at least two occasions, go to the police. And the police really were not very responsive. And I think the lack of taking this seriously is perhaps best demonstrated by the fact that on one occasion, after she had been terrorized and beaten by her husband and she went to the police, they issued her a temporary restraining order, which is something that exists under Salvadoran law. There have been a number of laws that have been enacted in El Salvador to address violence against women. It's a whole other story we could go into as to how they're absolutely ineffective, not properly implemented, have not reduced violence or reduced levels of impunity. But having said that, she did in fact get a temporary restraining order or protective order from the police. And then the police said to her, why don't you go serve this on your husband? And so you just have to think of the absolute absurdity of that. A woman who is terrorized, who has just been beaten by this abusive spouse, and who knows that having gone to the police will just enrage him even more, and then go to the police and they give her a protective order and they say, hey, why don't you go home and serve this on your husband? And the violence continued over a number of years with no checks on it by any of the authorities.
At one point, the police told her to leave the area. Where did she go and what happened?
Yeah, the police made a comment like, if you had any dignity, you would leave. Sort of like saying, you know, we're not here to protect you. You should protect yourself. And why don't you go somewhere? So she actually moved several hours away, and her husband was easily able to track her down to ascertain her whereabouts. And he came there and continued the abuse. And at a certain point, she even divorced him. And the comments that he and that his brother, the police officer, made it clear that the divorce was really meaningless to them. A comment was made, if you think this divorce will set you free, you're sadly mistaken. You will, you know, sort of always belong to him, to your spouse. And I think that goes to the fact that there is this attitude that's part of sort of a very deeply entrenched patriarchy or machismo. And again, not my words, but really women activists within El Salvador, there's this sense of treating women as property. And once, you know, they're property of their fathers, and then they're the property of the men that they're with, and that they don't have the autonomy. It's just not within the conceptualization of gender relations that the woman has the right to terminate that relationship.
So this woman called AB in the court documents, she comes to the U.S. and applies for asylum. And let's step back here and ask you, what do you have to prove in order to be granted asylum?
So I will answer that. I want to just back up one point, because I think this is important, that when she moved and when she divorced him, and she saw that that was totally ineffective in stopping his abuse. In fact, the abuse not only continued, but there were a series of very serious death threats from both her, by this time her former spouse, and his friends, and the brother-in-law, really saying, you know, be careful, you don't know where the bullets are going to fly, or, you know, you might end up dead, cut in little pieces in a plastic bag thrown in a river. And she took these threats very seriously, because in El Salvador, as in a number of the other Northern Triangle countries, El Salvador, Guatemala, and Honduras, the level of gender-motivated killings, or femicides, as they're called, is quite high. These are countries that have the highest levels of femicides in the world. And so when she was threatened in that way, that was really the final sort of point for her. That was a catalyst, the recognition that moving away, divorcing him, wouldn't make her safe, and that really the only option that she had was to leave the country. And so that was the point at which she fled. And this was after about 15 years of continuous abuse and threats. So then, returning to your question about the legal requirements for asylum, so for an individual to be granted asylum in the United States, they have to meet the definition of a refugee. And that definition is in the 1980 Refugee Act, enacted by Congress and based on international documents, the 1957 Refugee Convention and its 1967 Protocol. And it defines a refugee as an individual either who has suffered persecution or has a well-founded fear of persecution on account of race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. So the person has to either have suffered harm or have what's called a well-founded fear of harm. And it can't be just, you know, that they're afraid for any reason. It has to be that the reason that they are being targeted is somehow related to one of these five grounds that we call the protective grounds, the race, religion, nationality, political opinion, and membership in a particular social group. That's really the core definition.
What happens when the applicants, this is again the applicant for asylum in the U.S., when the person persecuting that person is not a governmental entity or actor, what must the applicant show or prove?
Right. So this is part the way in which the definition has been interpreted, that persecutor can be either the government or what we call a non-state actor. So individuals who are could be members of the family, could be members of society, could be gangs, could be cartels, could be vigilantes, could be white supremacists, you name sort of, we know there are lots of groups that are not per se the government formally, but are groups in society that may engage in violence. And so when the persecutor is what we call a non-state actor, the individual has to also prove that the government is either unable or unwilling to protect the person. And the rationale of that is that if the government can protect a person, can provide effective protection, the person is not in need of protection in another country as a refugee.
I'm CS. This is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. Karen Musallo joins me in studio. She is professor of law and director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings College of the Law. And we will talk more about what happens to the case of Ms. AB and her application for asylum in the U.S., but I want to ask you now about a key piece of background for what happens to her case, which is a decision that the Board of Immigration Appeals made in 2014. It was called the case of Matter of ARCG. So can you talk about that? And maybe we could start with the woman who was at the center of that case. She was Guatemalan. What did she suffer at the hands of her spouse?
So unfortunately, she suffered in ways very similar to Miss AB, just an endless, unrelenting physical and verbal and sexual abuse. The physical abuse included her husband throwing acid at her and burning her skin. I believe it was her breast that was very badly burned. She suffered broken bones. She suffered beatings and kickings so severe when she was pregnant that her child was actually, the baby was actually born with bruises. And, you know, I have to say for those of your listeners who might think these cases are exceptional within the context of the countries we're talking about, I have to say all too unfortunately that these are not uncommon, that this level of violence is all too common. So Miss ARCG suffered this, you know, again until she reached a point where she felt it was unbearable and her saving her life really required her leaving her her spouse, and she came to the U.S. and sought asylum. And I should mention that this issue of whether or not women who are survivors of brutal domestic violence, whether or not they qualify for asylum, had been a long-running dispute in U.S. law going back at least to 1999, which was the first kind of published decision or precedential decision on this issue. And it had been debated back and forth with three different attorneys general of the United States getting involved in this question, which really shows how, in a way, controversial it was. It was Janet Reno and then John Ashcroft and then Michael Mukasey. But finally, in 2014, the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is sort of like the Supreme Court in the immigration system. So immigration decisions by the Board of Immigration Appeals are binding precedent for what we call immigration judges and asylum officers who are decision makers. And the Board of Immigration Appeals finally in 2014 issued a precedent that said, yes, women who are fleeing domestic violence can meet this refugee definition. And, you know, here is how we analyze it. And I should mention that when the Board of Immigration Appeals did that, it was also had been supported, taking that position had been advocated by the Department of Homeland Security itself, which represents the government in these proceedings. And the Department of Homeland Security, at its sort of highest policy levels, had decided that this was the proper approach to take. And so they urged the Board of Immigration Appeals to do that. And that 2014 decision really brought to a conclusion, or so we thought, this long-running controversy about whether or not women in this situation met the refugee definition.
So this is the Board of Immigration Appeals decision, again, in August 2014. It was the matter of ARCG. So you told me that the successful applicant for asylum must fear persecution because of one of five protected grounds: race, religion, nationality, political opinion, or membership in a particular social group. So on what basis or on what protected grounds did the board, the BIA, approve asylum for Ms. ARCG?
So they approved it on the ground of membership in a particular social group, with that social group really being defined by different characteristics of Ms. ARCG, and or more broadly, sort of more broadly looking at Guatemalan society and defining it by the fact that she was a woman in Guatemala who was in this relationship to her husband. And I should probably step back and for some of your listeners and just explain a little bit so that this makes a little bit more sense to them. So these five grounds: race, religion, nationality, political opinion, and membership in a particular social group were sort of the grounds that were named for protection when the refugee definition first came into existence. And that membership in a particular social group was added. We're talking about a treaty that was drafted back in 1951. And many people think that ground was put in there to protect categories of people that might not be encompassed by those other four grounds of race, religion, nationality, or political opinion.
Yeah, it's a pretty general category.
It's general, but what the courts in the U.S. had ruled about membership in a particular social group going back to 1985, when they were asked, how do we define this? And this was actually in a case not having anything to do with women fleeing gender violence. But what the board, this was another decision by the Board of Immigration Appeals in 1985, and it said, well, those other grounds, race, religion, nationality, and political opinion, what do they have in common? Because this fifth ground should probably be interpreted in a way that's consistent with how we understand those other grounds. And the Board of Immigration Appeals said, well, those grounds all describe things about a person that they either can't change or shouldn't have to change. So race and nationality, you can't change if you think of nationality as meaning place of birth. And religion and political opinion, you shouldn't have to change to avoid persecution. So the board said, well, membership of a particular social group, therefore, should be defined by characteristics about a person that they can't change or shouldn't have to change. And they gave as an example a social group that was defined in part by gender. And so that had been a position that going back to the 1980s, and that the UN High Commissioner for Refugees had also advocated, that when women are persecuted because of things that have to do with their gender, that particular social group is really often the appropriate ground. And you could define, you know, it could be something like Cameroonian widows or Kenyan girls subject to female genital cutting. But it's you look at the gender, and then what are other things about the person that describe the reason why she's being persecuted? And so that particular social group, ARCG, what the board did in 2014 in its decision in ARCG was not really something ground-shaking or going out on a limb or really stretching to find that she could be included or protected within the particular social group ground. It was simply coming to a conclusion that for 20 or 30 years had been, you know, advocated by the UN High Commissioner for Refugees and adopted by many countries around the world when they apply the refugee definition.
That's Karen Musallo. She is a law professor and director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings College of the Law. Yeah, this ARCG decision, as you've indicated to me via the materials you sent me, has been reaffirmed numerous times. So let's now go back to the later case of the matter of AB, this Miss AB, who you told had to endure 15 years of severe domestic violence and abuse at the hands of her husband and then ex-husband in El Salvador. So who heard her asylum case? So she gets here and she's assigned a judge. Who heard her case and how did that judge rule?
So she had the misfortune to have her case heard by a judge, V. Stewart Couch, C-O-U-C-H, who sits in Charlotte. And he is known for having one of the highest denial rates of asylum seekers nationwide, way beyond what the sort of national average is, and seems to have a particular bias against claims involving domestic violence. And this was shown by a Freedom of Information Act request that a colleague did of his cases. And so she had the misfortune to appear in front of Judge Couch, who, for a number of reasons, denied her. One part of his decision was just disbelieving, you know, key aspects of her claim, invoking reasons that really were absolutely absurd and would have been laughable if it wasn't just so cruel to disbelieve her. And so when he denied her, she appealed to the Board of Immigration Appeals, which is the body that we've been talking about that issued ARCG in 2014. And the board reversed Judge Couch. The board basically, it went through his reasons for not finding her credible and found that they were not a legitimate basis for disbelieving her story. And then the board applied the principle of ARCG to her case and said she should be granted asylum. And the board sent the case back to Judge Couch for the sole purpose of carrying out the security check that is done on every asylum seeker before he or she can be issued a grant.
So Miss AB is justifiably elated by this decision by this three-member BIA panel, which reversed Judge Couch's decision. So is that the end of the story?
No, and unfortunately, and I think this just gives, if not the appearance of bias, the actual sort of proof of bias by Judge Couch, he basically disobeyed the BIA order. He sat on the case, months went by. If I'm not mistaken, it was 8 months that went by. And then the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, in other words, the Federal Circuit Court that covers this, you know, North Carolina, this area, issued a decision in a case that had nothing to do with domestic violence. But Judge Couch seized upon that decision and said, oh, the analysis in this decision shows that ARCG is incorrect, and therefore I'm not going to issue a grant. In fact, I'm going to send this case back up to the BIA. I'm sending it to the BIA. And I should note that what he did, you know, sitting on it all that time, obviously gives the appearance of impropriety. The case that he used to justify it, that he said was the reason why ARCG was no longer viable, legally, you know, most people would say legally incorrect. But this other thing of sending it back to the board, he had no legal authority to do that. And shortly after, the Attorney General Sessions learned about this case, and rather than letting the board review it again, the Attorney General reached out and took this case and said, I'm going to decide this case now. And there's another sort of, at least the appearance of impropriety, or one could speculate that Judge Couch was in communication with the Attorney General and flagging this case. So there's a number of things that just raise some, you know, serious questions about the bias and inappropriate or improper acts on the part of the immigration judge.
Karen Musallo is her name. She teaches law at UC Hastings College of the Law. She is also founding director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. We'll take a short break and speak more with Karen. Please stay with us. And this is Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. My name is C.S. Song. Karen Musallo is my guest, M-U-S-A-L-O. She is professor of law at UC Hastings. She directs the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. She's lead co-author of Refugee Law and Policy, a Comparative and International Approach, which is now in its fifth edition. And she was the first attorney to partner with psychologists in the representation of traumatized asylum seekers. She also edited the first handbook for practitioners on cross-cultural issues and on the impact of culture on credibility in the asylum context. So Jeff Sessions refers this case, the case of Miss AB, to himself for a decision. Under what authority did he take this case over?
So the attorney, there is a regulation that allows the Attorney General to take a decision by the Board of Immigration Appeals and to take jurisdiction over it and to decide it. But technically, this case was not at the Board of Immigration Appeals. And for lawyers, you know, regulations and rules and how things are supposed to be done, I mean, they create rights that are not supposed to be violated. This case was no longer in front of the Board of Immigration Appeals. The Board of Immigration Appeals had sent it back to the judge, and it was actually in front of the judge awaiting decision. So having said that, yes, he does have authority to take any decision. And I should mention, this might be a little bit of a side track here or side path, but attorney generals do have this authority, and this Attorney General Sessions has exercised it more aggressively than any of his predecessors. He has reached out, I think it was within a six-month period, he reached out and took four different BIA decisions with which he disagreed, because many of them gave certain rights to immigrants or asylum seekers, and reversed or vacated those decisions. So just to say that this is within that very aggressive position that he's taken and the administration has taken about trying to turn back immigrant rights and refugee rights.
So on March 7th of this year, he, Jeff Sessions, the Attorney General of the U.S., refers the case to himself. 3 months later, on June 11th of this year, he hands down a decision. What did he decide and how did he justify it?
Well, he decided that ARCG, the 2014 decision in which the BIA had said that claims of women fleeing domestic violence could meet the refugee definition, he said that it was wrongly decided and he vacated it. And then once he vacated it, he then reversed the board's grant of asylum to Ms. AB, and he sent the case back to Judge Couch for it to be decided now under the rules that he set forth in this lengthy decision. And I should say that he didn't just vacate matter of ARCG, but he issued these broad sweeping statements about claims in general, about claims involving women fleeing domestic violence, claims involving individual fleeing gangs, and issued these broad conclusory statements about how, generally speaking, these claims wouldn't meet the refugee definition because of this, that, and the other. But there's a whole body of law, refugee law, that's out there. You know, as I mentioned, the Refugee Act was enacted in 1980, and we have 38 years of precedent. And so, with or without ARCG, these cases can meet the refugee definition. And it's simply inappropriate to try to use this position. You know, we talk about people having a bully pulpit. Well, I actually talk about him as being a bully. He's trying to use this one decision to send a message to immigration judges, to asylum officers, to deny all of these cases. And it's having an effect because some of the guidance that has come out around how his decision is to be applied actually adopts that position, as if you could broadly foreclose whole categories of cases without doing an individualized case-by-case determination. He also, in his decision, in addition to reversing ARCG, we think that he clearly misrepresented what the law requires, and that he also paid absolutely no attention to any of the facts in the case.
Let's talk about another case that you are very interested in. In fact, the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies is co-counsel on. It's called Grace v. Sessions, and it has to do with, as I understand it, 12 plaintiffs who went through a series of horrific abuses. I mean, each one went through his or her own set of outrages. One person was targeted by gangs. A number of people were targeted by men that they knew. It was domestic violence, gender-based abuse. Maybe one way to get into Grace versus Sessions is to talk about what a credible fear interview is and what it tries to establish.
Yeah, so to explain credible fear interview, I have to explain this change in immigration law that goes back to 1996. Because before 1996, any individual who arrived to the U.S. at the border or was within the U.S. had the right to apply for asylum. You didn't have to establish anything before you had that right. We had the 1980 Refugee Act, and it said any person in the U.S. or at a port of entry or in between a port of entry can apply for asylum. And then in 1996, this was sort of another time when we had a rise of anti-immigrant restrictionism. There was this broad, quite restrictive Immigration Act passed, and it had a provision in it called expedited removal. And one of the main features of expedited removal is it took away that right of any individual who arrived to the U.S. to apply for asylum. And it put in a screening mechanism, and it said, henceforth, any individual who arrives to the U.S., who doesn't have a legal right to enter, you know, a visa or something of that nature, and most asylum seekers don't have legal documents to enter. So expedited removal said any individual who doesn't have a legal right to enter can be immediately removed without any access to a judge, to a court, to anything. Although if they are fearful, they have to first express that to a Border Patrol officer, and then the Border Patrol officer is supposed to send them to an asylum officer to have what's called a credible fear interview. And at that credible fear interview, the law requires that the individual establish what's called a significant possibility that they could establish eligibility for asylum. So in other words, we're saying, is this person a bona fide asylum seeker? Is there some possibility, a significant possibility, that they could meet that definition of a person with a well-founded fear of persecution on account of one of these grounds? If they are found to have a credible fear, then they are allowed to pursue a case for asylum in the United States. If they are not found to have a credible fear when they're interviewed by an asylum officer, they have one opportunity for a review. It's to an immigration judge. And if the immigration judge concurs with the asylum officer that they have not met that standard, then they are immediately removed. They have no access to any higher court. And I just want to underscore how dramatic of a change that is in U.S. law, because prior to 1996, an individual seeking asylum didn't have to be screened in, simply had the right to apply and to pursue his or her case all the way up into the federal courts.
And we could talk about you characterize the standard of a significant possibility of the person establishing eligibility for asylum as a relatively low standard. It's not like they have to say, prove that they are actually eligible for asylum, that they deserve a grant of asylum right then and there because they've proven everything they need to get asylum. We could talk about why the low standard, but I feel like we need to move forward. I'm wondering what the USCIS, this is the U.S. Citizenship and Immigration Services, what it said on July 11th of this year about this screening threshold, this threshold that people have to basically meet when they have a credible fear interview.
Right. So USCIS, which is part of the Department of Homeland Security, USCIS, its employees are asylum officers. And asylum officers are the ones conducting these credible fear interviews. So USCIS sent out guidance to its asylum officers about screening the credible fear process and basically said in bold point font that in general, claims that are based on domestic violence or gang violence will not establish a credible fear of persecution. So this was a dramatic change, and clearly it was, you know, explicitly and expressly citing to the Attorney General's decision in matter of AB to reach this, I think, absolutely erroneous conclusion that we could prejudge these claims, and generally speaking, they're not going to establish this low screening standard, and therefore they should just be not permitted to apply for asylum. They should just be removed.
What is the guidance, again, from USCIS? What does it do to the standard that, and you expressed this earlier, that home governments, this is part of meeting the requirements for asylum, that home governments be unable or unwilling to protect a person?
The USCIS guidance, along with what the Attorney General has said, really diverges from the law. So, you know, for decades, the standard has been, if you're persecuted by a non-state actor, you have to show the government is unable or unwilling. But what the Attorney General sort of converted those to is not just unable, but absolutely helpless. You know, you have to show the government is absolutely helpless to protect you, or not just unwilling, but actually complicit. And so this ratcheting up of the standard and really diverging from what the law is, we think is clearly legally erroneous. And applying it at the screening stage, which is supposed to be a low level of screening, is particularly egregious and incorrect. We haven't said this, but if I could just briefly say, you know, credible fear interview happens almost immediately after a person arrives at the U.S. They are often not represented by an attorney. They don't know anything about the legal standard. They haven't had anybody help them prepare their case. And now they're supposed to put forth what, generally speaking, you wouldn't have to establish until you got to a full asylum hearing where you would have documentation and put in all the evidence about the government's failure to protect you.
Karen Musallo teaches law at UC Hastings College of the Law, where she is director, founding director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies. You are listening to Against the Grain on Pacifica Radio. I'm C.S. Song. What does this USCIS guidance of July 11th say about asylum applicants with a personal relationship to their persecutors? So, for example, the case of an applicant who has been beaten and abused by their husband.
Yeah, so this is really the kind of analysis that is a throwback to a way of thinking about violence against women that really, you know, should be in the dustbins of history. I mean, the way in which the Attorney General and then USCIS following the Attorney General tries to characterize domestic violence is it's just a private personal dispute. And so therefore the abuser is not targeting his wife or his partner because she's a member of this particular social group, that she's a woman in Guatemala. He's targeting her because it's just a private dispute. And it's sort of tantamount to saying that domestic violence has nothing to do with gender. This is just a personal dispute. But this isn't like a man going across the street and having a conflict with his male neighbor across the street. This is happening within the context of an intimate relationship and all of the sort of gender dynamics and power relations. It is on account of this woman's gender. And I guess the other piece of it is that characterizing it as sort of a private dispute, this goes back to, again, another long-rejected concept that women's rights are not human rights. They're just like private dispute. And, you know, in the international human rights community, it was recognized a long time ago that, no, women's rights are human rights. This isn't just a personal dispute. This is a violation of human rights, and the government has a responsibility to protect.
On August 7th, the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings, which you direct, UC Hastings College of the Law, and the ACLU filed suit on behalf of 12 plaintiffs. Each presented claims to a screening officer, meritorious claims, according to the center and the ACLU, but were denied. So what does this suit ask for? What kind of relief is this suit requesting, demanding?
So basically, this change in the credible fear standard is this direct result of the decision in AB and the USCIS's guidance. And, you know, what we're asking for, the relief we're asking for, is to declare these new credible fear policies contrary to law. We ask that they be vacated, that the policies and the written guidance that that direct them, that they be vacated, that the government be prohibited from applying these policies in credible fear interviews, and that the individuals who are the named plaintiffs who were found not to establish a credible fear, that the order against them, the order that they be removed and not be permitted to seek asylum, that be vacated and they be given a new opportunity, a new credible fear interview under the proper standard.
There are other forms of gender violence that frequently arise in claims made by female asylum seekers. We've been talking a lot about domestic violence, but other practices include forced marriage, rape, sexual slavery, trafficking for labor or sexual exploitation, honor killings, and repressive social norms, for example, forbidding education or employment. And we've talked about some legal precedents that have been established in the U.S. around domestic violence, although I guess they are now in peril because of Jeff Sessions and the USCIS actions. Do binding legal precedents exist in the U.S. that assure protection for women who have encountered, you know, these other practices that I mentioned?
There is some clear precedent in some areas involving different forms of gender violence. And I know it sounds a little mushy, but for instance, it's been pretty well established now that in claims involving female genital cutting, that women who flee that can be considered members of a particular social group and be eligible for asylum. And I'm sure that your listeners who are, you know, very thoughtful people are sort of asking the question, well, if you can say women are a particular social group when they fear female genital cutting, then why wouldn't you say they're a particular social group when they fear domestic violence? And that's exactly right. This sort of distinction that has been made makes no sense because as the law has developed around these claims, there is this recognition that when women are harmed because of their gender, they fit within the particular social group ground. So there's clear precedent on female genital cutting. There is some positive precedent for women fleeing honor killings, for women fleeing trafficking for sexual exploitation. There's less clear precedent in some of these other areas, such as forced marriage, and now we see with domestic violence. So it's a bit of a moving target, and there's just some very deep-seated resistance to the fact that women fleeing gender violence have the right to protection. And it really, I mean, I understand the kind of, I have to say it, misogyny that underlies this, but it really makes no sense to me conceptually why people think that women fleeing these kind of harms where the government can't or won't protect them, why they don't meet the refugee definition under the social group ground. It doesn't make sense conceptually.
Many people fear that you open the door to some refugees and you thereby open a floodgate. And, you know, a lot of people could think, well, there are a lot of women who suffer abuse in various parts of the globe. And so if we start allowing them to not only apply for asylum, but get asylum in the U.S., we're just going to be flooded with women. What's your response to this floodgates argument?
Yeah, so there's really four things that I could say really quickly. One is, you know, I was the lead attorney in a case called Matter of Kasinga, which established the precedent in 1996 that women who flee female genital cutting qualify for asylum. And before the grant of asylum, I debated a lot of people. And the argument always was, this is going to open the floodgate. Do you know how many millions of women are subject to female genital cutting? They're all going to come to the U.S. if we, you know, grant asylum. The precedent was established in 1996. The government tracked the numbers of asylum claims from women fleeing female genital cutting. It was small. There was absolutely no, like, explosion of claims. Canada has accepted gender claims going back to 1993, if I'm not mistaken. They've looked at the numbers. No explosion of claims. So it just doesn't bear out that there's an explosion of claims or floodgates. But then I would say two other things, even if there were. You know, on the basis of the law and what the law requires, you know, we have obligated ourselves through domestic law and international law to protect people fleeing persecution. And the reason we have refugee, you know, international refugee protections is because of the failure of protection of people fleeing the Holocaust. And so floodgates is simply not an excuse. It wouldn't have been an excuse to say there's too many Jews. I mean, that's what people essentially did. And it was wrong then, was morally wrong then, it's morally wrong now. And I would just say to people who fear, you know, the floodgates and don't want to protect refugees, the smarter way to avoid a floodgate and the moral and ethical way is address the root causes. Why are people fleeing? And correct those conditions. Work, you know, have a smart foreign policy, have smart policies, and work with countries to eliminate gender violence or eliminate you know, violence against certain racial or ethnic or religious minorities, that's the way to avoid the floodgates. But throwing somebody fleeing persecution, you know, throwing somebody who's running out of a burning house back into that burning building, it is simply, you know, fundamentally so immoral and so wrong, and just not justifiable on a legal basis either.
And there are reasons you've cited, and it goes back to the conditions of women in their home countries. There are reasons why applications from abused women have not skyrocketed after positive decisions from U.S. or, for example, Canadian authorities.
Yeah, I mean, I think the reasons that they haven't skyrocketed are, you know, for many individuals, they don't want to leave everything they love behind, leave their family, leave their children, leave their lives, their language. So it's not so easy. It's not like everybody wants to come to the U.S. I know many people think that, but they don't want to come. So the numbers have not skyrocketed. And in many of these countries, women have so few civil and political rights that it just is not feasible for them to leave and come to the U.S. So I think there's lots of pragmatic reasons why there haven't been floodgates, even though we have accepted, an extended protection to certain people.
Your center, and again, this is the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings College of the Law, recently launched an advocacy campaign called Immigrant Women 2. Tell us about it.
So in addition to the litigation and other work that we're doing to challenge and try to turn back the Attorney General's policy, we hope to mobilize public opinion, to mobilize public opposition to this very broadly. And we think that this is an issue that shouldn't just be of concern to people who care about refugees or immigrants, but really this is fundamentally a women's rights issue and a human rights issue. And, you know, in the same way that Me Too and Time's Up is about recognizing the rights that women have, broadly speaking, we'd like to mobilize and sort of partner with people across the country who feel that it is wrong to send a woman back to her death. And so this campaign, we are just at the beginning stages of it, but we are going to, you know, provide people with different suggested ways to join the conversation, to express their opinions and their opposition to policymakers at particular, you know, points in time. And we have, if you go to our website at the immigrantwomen2.org that we've established for the campaign, or hashtag immigrantwomen2, and it's 2 spelled T-O-O, you can find out more about the campaign. Or you can, you know, follow me on Twitter. I tweet about it occasionally, and it's at Karen Musallo. So those are various things that if you want to know more about the work that we're doing to turn back AB, those are some ways that you can get additional information and decide whether or not you'd like to be involved.
And we'll put a link to the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies and a link to their Immigrant Women 2 campaign on our website, againstthegrain.org. Karen Musallo, Musallo, Professor of Law, Founding Director of the Center for Gender and Refugee Studies at UC Hastings College of the Law. Karen, thanks for the information. Thanks for your work. Thanks for joining us today.
Thank you very much for having me.
And this is CS, suggesting the important thing is not to stop questioning, as Albert Einstein once said. And we hope you'll join us next time. Against the Grain is produced by Sasha Lilly and C.S. Song. You can visit us online at againstthegrain.org, where you'll find on-demand and downloadable audio, resources, and more. You can check us out on Facebook at Against the Grain Radio, and you can follow us on Twitter at Radio Against.